for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. A lot can happen to a family in 100 years. Just ask Jane Smiley. Next week, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author will release the second installment of her trilogy that traces a century in the lives of the Langdons. They're an Iowa farm family. The first two books offer both an intimate family portrait and a far-reaching journey through mid-century America. Jane Smiley is with me in the studio to discuss her 20th novel. It's titled Early Warning. I know Jane Smiley has many, many fans in our audience. Feel free to join us at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Jane Smiley, how good to see you again.
Thank you.
Wonderful to see you and to really begin to imagine how you began to imagine. 100 years, Jane.
Well, the first thing that actually came to me was the title of the trilogy, which was The Last 100 Years. And that just came to me, and I mentioned it to a friend of mine, David Francis in L.A., who's also a writer, and he said to me, don't tell anybody that title because they will steal it.
Oh.
I thought, oh, that's a good review. And as soon as I thought about it, I knew it was going to start in 1920 because I wanted it to be about the modern world. I wanted the First World War to be over. And I knew it was going to start in Iowa because I really wanted to talk about the food production system, because I think the way people eat and how they produce their own food is really indicative of what the culture thinks of itself and how it perceives itself. And I also know, since I lived in Iowa for so many years, how much that's changed. And so as soon as those things came to me, excuse me.
Suffering a bit of a cold, aren't you?
No, it's just...
Or allergies, maybe.
No, probably allergies.
Okay.
Anyway, as soon as those things came to me, I knew that the children were going to have personalities, because I've had children, and they know that as soon as they're born, they have these very decided personalities and ways of doing things. And I thought, okay, I'm going to set them up, and then I'm going to send them out into the world. And writing the baby parts was really one of the most fun things for me.
But you've got so many characters in this book. In just this book, Early Warning.
Well, people get married.
Yeah, of course people get married. But you begin with a funeral.
Yes.
In Early Warning.
Yes, at the end of Some Luck, Walter, who's the farmer, who's only about 57 or 58, he goes out to do something. And then his son goes out to see where he is, and he discovers that he's died. And so that's the end of Some Luck. And then Early Warning begins with Walter's funeral, which is only a couple of days after.
And tell me about the title, Early Warning.
Well, the book takes place in the 1950s, and I was born in 1949. So the thing I most remember about the 1950s is... the Cold War, and that sense that we had in that period of time that life could be over it would take a half an hour. But I remember during the Cuban Missile Crisis, I said to my stepfather, are we going to go somewhere, drive west or something like that? And he said, no, we're going to sit right here because we don't want to survive. And when you're 12, that's a big thing to... I'm thankful to him for being honest, but it was an interesting moment in my life.
I was older than you at that moment, and I must say, the Cuban Missile Crisis was pretty pretty darn
It was very scary.
Scary.
It was very scary. And I really sort of remember it moment by moment because it took place while it started while I was at school. And then while I was being carpooled home, and then when I got home, I was sort of glad to see that everybody was still alive, you know. And that's just how it was. I remember also in the 50s, maybe it was during when the Gary, whatever his name was captured by the Russians.
Right, by the Russians.
I remember hearing it on the radio in my grandmother's house and putting my fingers in my ears and going, blah, 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 blah. So I didn't want to, because I didn't want to hear. I didn't want to hear.
And that brings me to a perfect opening for you to read for us from your book. The year, each chapter, we should say, has a year. And
yes,
I chose 1954 because that's the year I graduated from high school. So I want you to read that passage for us.
Okay. 1954. Now, let me just say ahead of time that there each year has several passages in it. So this is one of four or five passages in the year 1954. And they do proceed over the course of the year. So this would be in the late winter or spring, probably spring. Tina Manning was having her first birthday party. Debbie Manning had drawn the invitations with crayons on cards, and then she and Timmy walked all over the neighborhood by themselves to deliver them. Timmy was a good boy for once. He stood while they looked both ways when they crossed the street and did not pretend to run in front of cars. He had never actually run in front of a car, but sometimes he would stand on the curb jumping up and down and then jerk his body like he was going to do it. In the summer, a lady who was passing screamed when she saw him, and then Debbie herself screamed, and then Timmy fell down laughing. Debbie hoped that the lady would stop the car and get out and smack him, but she just shook her head and drove on. 15 invitations had taken Debbie 3 days of hard work. Mommy had had to give her Oreos to keep up her strength, but Debbie was happy to do it because Tina was a wonderful child. She had walked at 10 months, could already say Debbie, and would stick out her foot and let Debbie put her sock on or take it off again and again. Very soon, Debbie thought, she and Tina were going to have a horse, which they would keep in a silver spring. Debbie had a picture of this silver spring hanging above her bed. She'd used almost her entire gold crayon for the horse and her entire silver crayon for the spring. Debbie made sure that the gates at the top and the bottom of the stairs were always closed so that Tina would never tumble down them. Debbie put on her red velvet Christmas dress for the party and zipped it up the side all by herself. Then she put on her white socks with the lace around the tops and her black Mary Janes. She looked in the mirror. She looked very good. She opened the stair gate and closed it and locked it, then went down holding the railing just in case Timmy came along and pushed her. At the bottom of the stairs, she opened the gate and closed it. The clock on the mantel said 6 o'clock. She was the only girl in her kindergarten who could tell the time every time the teacher asked. Even though he was a year and a half older than Debbie, Timmy said that he could not tell the time or recite the alphabet, but Debbie knew that he could. When the doorbell rang, Daddy came in from the dining room, called out, "Just a minute," then kissed her on the forehead. She gave him her hand, and they went to the door. Daddy opened it. Outside in the cold, the Myers were standing on the step, the two boys behind them, their mom and dad. Their mom said, "Ah, Arthur, you look ready to have a good time." Daddy said, "Mary, darling girl, step right in. Hi, boys. Lillian and Tina are holding court in the dining room so that you warriors can use the living room for your battles." Debbie mouthed the name Mary. 4 girls in her first grade class were called Mary. That was how it went for a long time. The doorbell rang, and they went to the door, and people came in. And most of the time, they handed Daddy a bottle and handed Debbie a wrapped present and said, "So, where's the birthday girl?" The birthday girl was standing in her playpen, and as each set of guests brought in their present, Debbie arranged the stack in front of her. Soon, all the parents were laughing and talking very loudly, and the other kids were running from room to room, playing tag. Timmy loved tag. He was always it. If he tagged you, you had to sit down in the nearest chair and pretend you were dead. The last child to get tagged would get a prize, but the prize was just an old toy cowboy or something like that. Finally, Mommy came over and said, "Deb, I need your help with the cake." Debbie followed her to the back hall, and then Mommy told her to hold out her hands, and into them she placed the yellow cake with pink frosting they had made the night before. "Happy birthday, Tina," was written across the cake in green letters. The cake was only one layer and not heavy. Debbie carried it carefully on its silver platter into the dining room, and all the children and parents started clapping. Daddy had gotten Tina out of the playpen and stood her on a chair at the head of the table. She had a big white napkin tied around her neck, and her hair was sticking out all over her head. Debbie set the cake in front of her on the table. Everyone sang happy birthday, and Tina stared all around for a moment, and then right when they got to, "Dear Tina," she flopped forward like a rag doll and put her face in the cake. When she stood up again, she had cake in her hair and on her chin. Mommy said, "What a clown," and everybody laughed much more than Debbie thought they should.
And short break, we'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org. From the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, seeking to unlock the possibility inside every individual at gatesfoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back. Jane Smiley is with me. She is, of course, just a fabulous writer. I first had her on after she wrote her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, A Thousand Acres, which was kind of a very modern take on the King Lear play. Now, the second in her 100-year trilogy, it's titled Early Warning. She's here with me, and just before the break, she was reading from a passage that I so adore, but because of time constraints, she was not able to read the last portion. What I want you to do, Jane.
Okay.
Is start again where that cake gets put in front of little Tina. What happens then? Go ahead.
Okay. Daddy had gotten Tina out of the playpen and stood her on a chair at the head of the table. She had a big white napkin tied around her neck, and her hair was sticking out all over her head. Debbie set the cake in front of her on the table. Everyone sang happy birthday, and Tina stared all around for a moment. And then, right when they got to, "Dear Tina," she flopped forward like a rag doll and put her face in the cake. When she stood up again, when she stood up again, she had cake in her hair and on her chin. Mommy said, "What a clown!" And everybody laughed much more than Debbie thought they should. At that very moment, Debbie decided she did not want any of the pigs in a blanket she had helped make, or the carrot raisin cake, or the other cake, the two-layer one meant for eating. She backed away, slipped through the living room, unlocked the gate, locked it again, and tiptoed up the stairs. In her room, her dolls were quiet on the bed. She got out of her red velvet dress and put on her Minnie Mouse pajamas. Poor Debbie.
Poor Debbie.
Things are never the way she wants them to be. I'm so sorry.
Exactly. It's kind of a foretelling of how her life goes.
Her dad really wants to have this big, adventurous, wild family because he did not grow up that way. And as in every family, the children have their own opinions about what kind of family they want. And Debbie really has a hard time handling the chaos. She's the second child. The older child is a boy. And one of the things I think that motivated me concerning this book was all the men I know of my generation who had very wild childhoods. And when they now tell the stories, you sort of go, I can't believe you did that. How did that happen?
What do you mean wild childhoods?
Oh, just going to all these places. Like, one of my friends, actually my husband, remembers going to a place, and I put this in the book too, and he and his friends would sneak up a waterway to up a hill to where the older kids were making out in their cars, and they would throw cherry bombs underneath this particular drainage, and the people in the cars would freak out, you know.
When he rolled over, of course. You know what struck me?
My son's father grew up in Clinton, Iowa, and his parents had lots and lots of children. So his parents, their rule for the kids was, once you could swim the width of the Mississippi River, you could go out on your own. And my son's father could do that by the time he was 9 or 10. So those days were different.
And that is exactly what I was thinking of when you were talking about Timmy and Debbie walking across the street. And the parents here in the area, I don't know if
yes,
you
I do
read
know about
them,
yes.
Who allowed their children to go to the playground by themselves and have had those children taken away from them? What has happened to our society?
Well, people have become so anxious, you know.
Exactly.
And I remember that my mother was anxious, but it never occurred to her to stop us, to stop me or the other kids from doing things. And so we ran around the neighborhood and we did this and that. And my mother's excuse probably was that she was at work. And so my grandmother's excuse probably was, it's a lot safer than it was when I was a kid or when my children were kids. So I think it was an interesting period, the 50s and the baby boom generation, because as I talk about in the first volume, the World War II generation was pretty much working all the time, especially if they were on a farm. And the baby boom generation, in some ways, was the first generation that didn't have to work at the family business. But there were plenty of kids, so you ran around with your friends, and you got in trouble sometimes.
So in early warning, you have only one child who decides he wants to stay on the farm and continue to
work. That's the second son, Joe.
And that's Joe. Mm-hmm. Tell us about Joe.
Well, in some luck, Joe and Frank is the older one, and Frank gets out of town. He goes, he enlists in the Army in World War II, and then once that's over, he ends up on the East Coast. But
making
Joe stays
on the money.
Yes, making a lot of money. But Joe stays on the farm. He's always loved farming. He's always loved animals. His idea of how he was going to farm was that he was going to have a lot of named animals. But when he grows up, he realizes that this is not going to be true. But he still loves the farm. And so he's the one who continues farming the land. And he takes on a little bit of Walter. Walter, you might remember from Some Luck, is always worried. And Joe never expected to be. But once he's in charge of the farm, he's a little worried too. But he's a good farmer. He's very competent. And his only anxiety, I remember one of the things I put in about his anxiety is that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, after the installations were installed in Nebraska, he's a little nervous when he's driving the tractor to the east, and he's always tempted to look over his shoulder to see if there's a mushroom cloud on the horizon.
Wow.
But that's only part of his life. He has a good life.
But, you know, it seems to me that in addition to the Cuban Missile Crisis, you go through a number of issues mm-hmm. and events, historical mm-hmm. events, happened throughout the book. But they're never quite the main focus at the moment they happen. For example, Bobby Kennedy's assassination. Mm-hmm. For example, Vietnam. One of the sons dies mm-hmm. in Vietnam. So, I mean, it's as though you have this huge tableau and you're moving people around while the events themselves are sort of in the background.
Well, I wanted to talk about the events as they appear and feel to just average
ordinary people.
And it's not so much that there's a tableau of events out there. It's more that I set up these characters and send them into the world, and inevitably some encounter various events and some don't. Now, Tim does end up in Vietnam. He's Arthur's son. And Tim is the wild one that we were just talking about in that previous chapter. And he's wild. He's wild all through high school. And he finally gets into college, but he's wild in college.
He drinks. How is he wild?
He drinks. He gets in trouble. He's interested in girls. He meets one girl who's a little wilder than he is. But he's contrary. You know, he just hasn't found his niche. And so he gets drafted. And if he had stayed in college because of the draft permit for students, he wouldn't have gotten drafted. But he gets drafted, and he's not that sorry to get drafted because he sees the Vietnam War maybe as an adventure more than as a danger. But you know that I knew guys like that too. You know, who didn't really care whether they were drafted or not because they wanted to see what was going on. They wanted to get out into the world. But my whole plan all along was to have my characters take their own temperaments, let's say, and predilections into the world and then process what was going on in the world as best they could. One of my favorite characters is Andy, who's Frank's wife, and she is from Decorah, Iowa, and she's very Scandinavian in her approach to things. And she's simultaneously very cool and terrified all the time.
So she's in psychoanalysis.
Yeah, so she goes into psychoanalysis, and she gets, and there are various theories that she goes, she goes from one to the other. And she cannot tell the truth. When they ask her to tell her dreams, she tells episodes from books she's read, and why she does that, she can't. She's not convinced they can help her. I think she's not convinced that the terror that she feels can be fixed. And one of the things during the Cold War part, one of the things that she remembers is the story of the end of the world in Nordic mythology. And there are people, and she says, yes, there were people who were reborn, but their names weren't Andy, Frank, Janet, Michael, and...
Five children. One of the things I want to take you back to is, as we said, it begins with Walter's funeral and everybody gathering. His widow...
Oh, Rosanna, yeah.
Rosanna had never learned to drive until after Walter
died. That was like my grandmother. My grandmother never learned to drive.
So I understand where this is coming from, because I think there are a lot of women of that generation who totally depended on...
Well, driving
on...
was hard in those old, in those original cars.
That gear shift. I learned to drive in high school, so it was easy for me. But she finally learns to drive. She makes her way finally out onto the highway. And finally, she makes it all the way to Chicago.
Well, one of the sons is an intellectual, and he works at Evanston. He teaches at Northwestern University. And so one day, she says she's coming, and she decides to come, and she gets there. But then his name is Henry, and Henry is talking on the phone, and then he senses something has gone wrong, and he goes and he sees in her room that she's died. And they don't ever know why. It's probably some kind of a stroke or heart attack or something. She's 78, and it's a very peaceful ending for her.
It's a peaceful ending, but they do have a sweet exchange. She thinks she's somewhere else just before she dies.
Yeah, she remembers being at home, being back on the farm, driving a horse through town.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. All right, I'm going to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Your questions, comments for Jane Smiley, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 1,000 Acres, and the first of the trilogy is titled Some Luck. We're now talking about the second, and that's titled Early Warning. Let's go first to George in Kissimmee, Florida. Have I pronounced that correctly, George?
Kissimmee, Florida, the land of Mickey and Minnie.
Okay, go ahead.
Long-time fan, also I found this a fascinating topic because so many things are changing in society. I was interested in rock and roll, the burgeoning of rock and roll. You know, it must have been exciting, this new music. But there was also in society a lot of insecurity, and a lot of people even saw it as a threat, you know, that gyration, the loss of control.
And Elvis Presley, I mean, came out during his era. He shocked people.
Well, Tim, like so many boys in that era, decides he's going to be in a band and when he's in high school. And so he is in a band a little bit. But, yes, everybody loves rock and roll and has their particular affections. You know, maybe Elvis, maybe the Beatles, maybe the Rolling Stones. They show up a little bit, but they don't actually. I don't know any of them, so they didn't come on stage.
You don't know any of them. Yeah, I understand. How much of your own early life is in here?
Really, almost none. I mean, I grew up in St. Louis. I didn't grow up on a farm. And I think I probably picked and chose a few things, like, for example, my anxiety about mutually assured destruction. But I've heard so many stories over the years of wonderful things, that wonderful bits of trouble that various people got into, that was sort of the source of a lot of the adventures of the kids.
But You know, at the same time, the 50s were such, even with those early warning signs, it was such a time of economic growth. And on the farm early on, he sees prices rise. He sees his farm thriving.
Yes, in the 50s and 60s and into, let's say, the early 70s, the farm does fine. And then there's the farm crisis. Walter's, the patriarch, has always been suspicious about the relationship of the size of the crop to the amount of money that you're going to get for it. Joe isn't as suspicious. He thinks that the market works.
The market works. And we'll take a short break here. When we come back, more of your calls, your comments. I look forward to speaking with you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the financial services firm of Raymond James. For over 50 years, offering wealth management, banking, and capital markets expertise with a focus on putting the client's financial well-being first. Learn more at raymondjames.com. From the Lemelson Foundation, committed to improving lives through invention in the U.S. and developing countries. On the web at lemelson.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
On the next Fresh Air, we hear from Will Forte, who created and stars in the new Fox comedy series Last Man on Earth. He's a former cast member of Saturday Night Live and co-starred in Nebraska. Also, some insights into singing from the chorus master of the Metropolitan Opera, Donald Palumbo. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back. We're going to go right back to the phones. Let's go first to Jody in St. Louis, Missouri. Jody, I think Jane knows what's coming.
Oh, this is my first love, Jody. And the wild, and one of the wild boys.
He was one of the wild boys. Oh,
yeah.
Really? Jody?
He taught me to do a lot of bad things.
Hi, cuz.
Hey, Jody, how are you?
I'm really good. Hey, do you mind if I tell a story on you?
No, not at all.
Okay. Diane, we all knew in the family that Janie was very motivated to write, and that's probably best illustrated by her first story. She ran out of materials to write with, and she finished the story with an eyebrow pencil.
I don't remember that.
That's great. That's great. So, Jody, you and Jane have kept in touch all these years.
As best we can, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, have you read the latest book?
No. Let me tell another story on her.
One quick one.
When she read, when she wrote, I came to visit her after she had written 1,000 Acres, and I said, I really want to apologize to you. I have not read 1,000 Acres. And she said, I don't care if you read my book. I just want you to buy my book.
The truth is out.
Well, there you go. Jody, it's good to hear from you and to hear your stories. Take good care. Let's go to Joy in Tulsa, Oklahoma. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
This is not about the book because I have not read the book, but I am a beekeeper in Oklahoma. Iowa to me means corn. Corn is 90% GMO. I am worried about the bees. Have you gone back and investigated if there are any bees? We were told in Oklahoma that there are no bees.
I have not gone back to investigate about the bees, but I bring up the subject of the GMOs and I talk about that mostly in volume 3, but some in volume 2.
So you've already, have you finished?
Yes, volume three is finished.
Wow.
But I think it's I grew up in St. Louis. Guess what's the biggest employer in St. Louis? You know who. And so this is a big concern for me, and I think it's increasingly a big concern in Iowa and for people in Iowa. But there's been no solution yet, and we wish there would be. But
indeed.
I'm really not a fan of GMOs. Really not. Really
All
not.
Right,
really
let's
not.
Go to Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're
oh, God, another relative.
Yeah, maybe so. You never know.
This is on my dad's family was off
hey,
from Lansing.
Hey, Ken, you're on the air.
Hi there, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really identified with the character, the troublemaker.
Uh-huh, Frank.
It was expelled from college and drafted, of course, in 1968 during the Tet Offensive.
Oh, yeah, that's Tim,
Yeah, I knew I'd be cannon fodder, so I went under the wire and joined the Navy for 4 years really did consider it an adventure. I was never in danger. We had dry beds and 3 meals. But I remember during high school, for part of our pranks, we used to get up on a railroad bridge and drop water balloons in the convertible that get somebody to chase.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, I'll contact you later.
Yeah. Okay, here's an email from Timothy in Pittsboro, North Carolina. He says, I wonder if one of my favorite characters in an earlier Jane Smiley novel will appear somewhere in the new trilogy. I'm particularly fond of the prize hog, Earl G. Butts, and would like to know if he makes a reappearance.
Oh, I can't say that he does, but I must say that when I was in Washington in the fall with some luck, a guy came up to me at the bookstore and said that his father was Earl Butts. And he was really, really flattered that I had named the hog Earl Butts. And I nearly fell out of my chair. And I said, why? And he said, because he's such a kind hog.
Oh, I like
that. So
that
I should be able to bring him back, but I didn't bring him back.
I like that. Let's go to Edna in Concord, New Hampshire. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I'm very excited about this because I just started reading last evening 1,000 Acres, mm-hmm. and I'm quite fascinated by it. I had lived in Iowa for 4 years and endured the heat and the humidity.
Oh,
but however, I find this
try St. Louis is way worse.
Quite exciting that you mentioned the children of, I don't know, some relative or your grandmother or so forth, who had allowed the children to, once they could leave the premises, they could leave and swim across they were able to swim across the Mississippi. Now, I remember the Mississippi. I lived in Davenport,
mm-hmm.
and it seemed like quite treacherous.
It was very wide. It wasn't where they were living, which was in Clinton.
They
were above the dam, so it wasn't quite as wide. But this person remembers, you know, seeing the catfish, which were huge. Yeah. You know, yes, it was dangerous, but you kind of expected the kids. They also remembered taking their 22s and walking along the railroad tracks and killing pheasants, not peasants, but pheasants. And so, yes, what were they thinking? Well, I have no idea. My kids.
I think that's wonderful. Wonderful to allow your children to have some freedom, but of course I understand the circumstances today. And the other question is, Sam and Arabella Davis, the grandparents, now that is an exciting history coming from West England and farming, and I really find this fascinating. I just started the book, and I am excited about reading it, and I enjoy your prose and so forth, and it's wonderful.
Thank you.
Good, and I promise you every single word of A Thousand Acres excited me.
Oh, it did. Good.
It really did. A really, really exciting book. Let's go to Kenneth in Richmond, Virginia. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Diane.
Hi.
Hi, Jane. I'm so happy to be joining both of you today.
Thank you.
The question that I have, Jane, is I'm a student of history. I actually recently graduated from VCU here in Richmond in history. And so I was wondering, what is your favorite part of the writing process as far as diving right back into different eras? I know that that's always a good escape, especially for my generation. I'm 23.
Mm-hmm.
So getting to read novels that take us back instead of just kind of dry regurgitations from textbooks that we can sometimes get used to or picture things as. I just wanted to know how you can completely kind of allow us to immerse ourselves in that, what your favorite part of that writing process is.
Well, probably what motivates me is curiosity. So as soon as I came up with the title, The Last 100 Years, I thought, oh, that's interesting, and it'll require a lot of research. And so I started reading, and as soon as I started reading, I would think, oh, that's interesting.
What were you reading?
Books about, it could be anything. It could be books about farming. It could be a childcare book from long, long ago. It could be a book about how to milk a cow.
Any novels?
No, because usually I don't want to be influenced by the style or the vision of another author. I remember when I wrote Moo and reread it, I realized how much I'd been influenced by David Lodge.
Huh.
And I love David Lodge books, that especially Small World. But I want to know more facts. I also like to go to the place, if I can, that where the book is set. So, for example, when I was writing The Greenlanders, I went to Greenland, and that was very eye-opening. So as much as I can, I like to go places and look around, and it's always a revelation when you go to the place.
You know, you've got in this book several different marriages.
Yes.
And styles of marriage. And behavior within mm-hmm. the marriage.
Can I say one thing about that?
Sure.
Well, one of the things that interested me about the marriage in the first volume, which is Walter and Rosanna's marriage, they have so much work to do around the farm that the first idea in their mind is not, am I happy? Am I satisfied? Am I getting along with my spouse? And that changed in the 50s because...
Totally.
And then marriages became much more focused on how do we get along. And I figured my characters, who had their various temperaments and desires, would have different kinds of marriages. And so they did. So Lillian, who's the child number three, the first girl, she has a wonderful marriage. Her husband adores her. Frank's marriage looks like it's going to work out. They look like they are getting, they have this sort of romance early on. And then the anxiety of the 50s sets in, and Andy, his wife, really doesn't know why? And I don't think Frank is introspective like that, so he wouldn't even ask himself why. Joe's marriage is in some ways a marriage of convenience. And I don't think they would say that it was happy or unhappy. I think they would just say it works.
It seems to me that as you look around, or as I looked around in those years, I could probably see those different kinds of marriages. Mm-hmm. I got married in 1959, mm-hmm. so joining a church, seeing married couples up close, you really saw those different styles. And then you saw a lot of those marriages in the 60s and 70s go kaput.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing that happened was a lot of marital advice. So it seems like people started having theories of marriage. What is it for? What are you supposed to get out of it?
What do I want?
What do I want?
Yeah.
Who am I in the marriage? And that's been an ongoing controversy now in the U.S. Since then. And that's one of the things that Andy goes to her psychoanalyst for. You know, what is his theory of marriage and his theory of how I'm going to make my life work?
And what happened with Andy did, in fact, happen in a great many mm-hmm. situations of psychoanalysis during that period.
And but we're not saying what
happened. We're not saying what happened. I stopped short. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Ann in St. Louis, Missouri. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'm calling from St. Louis, and I only have one question. Jane, where did you go to high school?
That's the St. Louis question. I went to John Burroughs. Where did you go to high school?
I'm a class of 74 from Normandy High School.
Oh, okay, cool.
So I live by in Corner Ward Academy, but one of nine children, so we went to Normandy.
You bet, yeah. There is a character who turns up in St. Louis, so St. Louis gets into the book.
That's great. All right, and let's go quickly to Norman, Oklahoma, and to Martha. You're on the air.
Good morning. This program is just fabulous. I'm just thrilled.
Thank you.
To hear you. Jane, I'm wondering, how did you approach writing from a baby's point of view in Some Luck in particular? And then you've been talking about Debbie's point of view,
yeah.
Early warning. And you've mentioned several times the importance of temperament. I assume you mean inborn temperament. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you believe that this is really more important than the environment that a person grows up in.
Well, let me first say how sometimes writing from the baby or the child's point of view was rather difficult.
I can imagine.
But I tried to focus on what the baby could realistically be seeing or feeling at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Once they get to be children, you know, like three or four, then they have definite points of view about things, and that wasn't so hard. I am a big believer that there are some children who have very strong temperaments from the day they're born, and there are other children who are more flexible. And so I think that there are some children who are more receptive to nurture or the world around them, and some children who are just themselves for the rest of their lives. They are just themselves.
Mm.
And I see in my own children so many resemblances to the way they were when they were kids. And it fascinates me. They're now entirely grown up. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have three. My husband has two. And all of them are grown up. And we talk all the time about how they haven't changed a bit.
From the time they've learned a lot.
They've learned a lot. But
sure.
The way that they process what they've learned is very important.
So you think that that's apparent very, very early?
Yes, and I always say all I ever learned about genetics I learned from Wuthering Heights, you know, because Wuthering Heights is really about two generations of a family and how they respond to a particular person and to a particular environment. And it's really interesting in Wuthering Heights to see how the children of the second generation resemble the children of the first generation.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get some of that in here, too.
So you finished the trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to travel around the country talking about the trilogy. What's next?
I don't know.
It'll come to you.
Something will happen.
Something will happen.
I have some children. I had a set of children's horse books, well, middle school horse books, and I would like to go on with that. So that's probably my first plan.
My granddaughter would be very happy with that. Jane Smiley, she is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 1,000 Acres, the second book in her trilogy about 100 years, is titled Early Warning. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me. It's been
great.
Good
to see you.
Thank you.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Timothy Olmsted. Natalie Yerblifker answers the phones.